both too tired to sleep.
You know, in the so we took turns in the lighting of our Zoom session here, there's a little resemblance to a Bruce and a younger Kenny Rogers there. It's pretty nice. Bruce Pratt joining us for this afternoon's Sports Lit 101 from the home studio. Welcome back, Bruce.
I'm glad to be back. I've never been mistaken for him. I was mistaken for Richard Dreyfuss once by an ardent older woman, older than I am now, who wouldn't take no for an answer. So I did sign his autograph. It was like, and you know, I later told somebody that, and they said, you know, he's the kind of guy who would think that was sweet of you to do. I said, good, I hope so.
Hey, there you go. Not her, so much when she tries to sell it on eBay, but
right, yeah. No, she had this one of those vinyl-covered autograph books. This was in a supermarket in Southwick, Massachusetts. I'm going out to my then 5-year-old, slightly rusted Pinto station wagon with a 2-year-old child in a seat, and she still thought I was Richard Dreyfuss.
Wow.
But, nice lady. Yeah, so this week, this is an interesting book, and it came to me in a roundabout way. Joseph Stanton is a professor at the University of Hawaii in Manoa, originally from St. Louis, and like Geechier and so many of those Midwestern guys, they are Cardinals fans through and through forever. And he wrote an entire book of poems called Cardinal Points. Now, he also wrote a wonderful book called Lifelines, we'll talk about later, which is ekphrastic poems, which are poems written about works of art. And many of them relate to Maine. But in this, he starts at sort of the beginning of the Cardinals, if you will, in the early 1900s. And by decades has poems that have to deal with the Cardinals. Now, there's something about this that there's a point to all this that people should know before I even begin reading some of these. People in the Midwest believe, and this is not an incorrect belief totally, I don't think, that St. Louis is the last great baseball town. That the Cardinals win, lose, draw, have rabid fans. They don't dwell on the successes. They don't look at the past and have an arrogant view like the Yankees. They don't whine like the Red Sox when they don't win. They're fans. This is their perception of baseball in the Northeast, you know. And some of that we are guilty. But I want to start with the first poem in the book, which is called Cardinal, and it does a little language play and it sets this up. Cardinal. Cardinal is, above all else, a red-letter word, a strikingly hued approbation as much as a bird, a matter of foremost importance, paramount, a lofty rank from which popes spring eternal. Rules, sins, directions, and numbers count as cardinal, if they are worth the trouble. Cardinal red blushes, dark, vivid, and deep. Cardinal cardinalis is a species name that bears repeating, a sudden trill of lilting, swelling, long song, limpid, floating beyond glorious, across summer afternoons arising from a finch. North American and male, hopping from branch to branch, or perched on two sides of a bat, or rounding third and heading for home, that seems so very far away, at least 2 plane rides and several decades of grief against all probability, but compelled by desire, a matter of foremost importance. Cardinal also means hinge upon and belong to, and year after year in sickness or in postseason, I do. Now I'm going to come back to that with a great story that's in here that's also a poem. Ducky Medwick went to the Vatican to meet the Pope.
That could be the title of a great poem right there. Ducky Medwick went to the Vatican.
Well, yes, we're going to read that one next. I've got so many of these I want to find it exactly. Because it's perfect, Ducky. Ducky's visit to the Vatican. 4 lines. Hello, Your Holiness. I'm Joseph Medwick. I, too, used to be a cardinal.
That's fantastic.
That's just fantastic. And there, throughout the book, there are just so many great stories in here that he's told in poems. About great players. There's one about Rogers Hornsby. The incomparable Rogers Hornsby. The level of perfection has its quirks, and teammates scoffed at his proscriptions, his refusal to watch a film or read a book for fear his batting eye might lose precision. But who could argue with results this fine? His average was 358 lifetime. And then there was 1924, the year he hit 424 and led the league in slugging and walks received. With careful tending of his precious eye, he reached base at least half the times he tried. And that's a pretty remarkable thing when you think of it. I don't follow sabermetrics or things like that, but that's got to stand out. This is a great poem. I really like this one a lot. It's called The Pepper Martin World Series. In 1931, when America was depressed in more ways than one, the wild horse of the Osage, nature's nobleman, John Pepper Martin, a chunky, unshaven hobo who ran the bases like a berserk locomotive, almost single-handedly destroyed the hopes of George Earnshaw, Lefty Grove, and the rest of the last of Philadelphia's great athletics. A triumph of a very common man, in days when most buddies could not spare even the thinnest of dimes, when sorrow rained hard and pennies from heaven only fell in songs. When rookies like Pepper were played so little, he chose to hop trains from Oklahoma to spring training in Florida and showed up late because some ornery cops nabbed him vagrant and tossed him into jail. He strove harder than all the rest of us and dove headfirst to catch the ball or steal the base. Some complained he made plays look hard, but none could deny the startling grandeur of Pepper at play in the fall of 31. Fans who were just as dirt poor as Pepper loved to tell the tale of Martin's post-game chat with the Lord High Commissioner, in which Landis declared, "Young man, I'd like to trade places with you." And Pepper replied, "Why, that'll be fine, Judge, if we can swap salaries, too."
That's great.
And all of these have been very carefully researched. Now, let's look ahead to the 1940s and 50s. Those were poems from before that. And this one is called Harry Carey's Voice. And there's a lot in here about announcing in baseballs. And I was thinking about Crack of the Bat books we've talked about with great announcers, and how John Miller could imitate all the announcers, and how that makes life baseball comes to life in those memories. Harry Carey's voice. His voice rising garish, garrulous above our barbecue pits was summer. His deep voice high-pitched to a blue sky falsetto when the game was on the line. Those excited moments stick to the mind beyond what memory of what happened and why it mattered if it did. The excitement was a game unto itself. Hearing his voice on my way to someone's backyard while rounding some corner on my bike, I could not know whether Boyer had slammed a homer, Musial had laced a timely line drive, Gibson had drilled a hole in McCarver's glove for a third strike on Clemente, Banks, or Matthews. It was not the hearing that was so wonderful, but the overhearing. That voice, its rise and fall, the chatty silliness of its commentary, the outrageous confidence of its insane predictions that so strangely often came true. That outrageous, unlovely voice so wonderful to overhear from a distance while rounding a corner on a bike. That voice meant summer was still out there, like a big, slow Kurt Simmons curve that might never stop floating. You know, I remember you, Rich, talking about how you could ride your bike at night in the neighborhood and sort of keep track of the game as you went along, because people would be out on their porches where the windows would be open, and that. This is one that of his called Ken and Cleet. There's a lot of ones that are about pair of ball players. Cleet Boyer was one of my boyhood heroes when he played third base for the Yankees. The Boyer boys were so alike in appearance and excellence of play, and by happenstance, they both found themselves manning the hot corner. Though both were raised uprightly in a close-knit family of ardent Cardinal devotees, regretfully, one brother ended up only a New York Yankee. There's a lot of this very parochial kind of stuff, which makes it hometown. It makes it fine to listen to. And then I guess we'll finish. There's so many great ones here. Finish with two more. This one I really love. It's called Bob Gibson. No player I ever saw that I admired more than Bob Gibson. Bob Gibson, a gentleman in his heart of hearts, he seldom let his kind side show. A fierce desire to win fueled a murderous ferocity of eye and arm. Even his catchers dreaded approaching his fiery mountain. "All you know about pitching is it's hard to hit," he snapped at McCarver more than once. Off duty, he could play the clown, sometimes beating poor Euchre at his own jokes. But in his office, he was on his own personal real estate industry, declaring again and again his ownership of the corner. Many of a foe earned a bruised shoulder by doubting it. Neither the years nor the Hall of Fame has mellowed him. Don't lean too close to this poem. And we'll finish up with just one more. One of my favorite, really colorful players was Al Raboski, the Mad Hungarian.
Oh, yeah.
He called. He was just great to watch on the mound. Whether it was an act or not, it was great. And this is called Al Raboski, the Mad Hungarian. We'll finish with this, and we'll have the author, we'll have Joe Stanton on with us somewhere down the line. Called Al Raboski, the Mad Hungarian. The passionate pitcher, handsome, hirsute, darkly glowering, Fu Manchu mustachioed, would stalk off the mound, turn his back to the hitter, and listen intently for moments that stretched out like weeks to whatever demons were speaking to him from the empty center field seats. And then, signaling his readiness by pounding ball into glove, he would whirl and turn the gathered horror of his angered gaze toward the poor sap at the plate, who was waiting nervously, nervously armed only with a stick of wood. And then at last, the long-awaited pitch, a laser beam dead onto the target, propelled as much by attitude as arm speed. During his two best years with the Cards, his fans adored his Rasputin-esque routine. When Austin snubbed them for the All-Star team, the fans turned a game against the Dodgers into a We Love Raboski banner day. And the Mad Hungarian got the win amid loving banners sporting jives like, "The smog is not the densest thing in L.A."
That's great.
These are really, really good. And this is over 100 pages long. All kinds of great poems about the Cardinals, some really subtle digs at Northeastern paternalism, a dig at Ken Burns about being too Boston and Yankee centric in his baseball stuff, but all really good, interesting things. I'm looking forward to having him join us and then to talk about his poems about Winslow Homer and Edward Hopper, because I think they speak to Maine as well, because certainly Homer and Hopper are things that speak to Maine. So anyway, that's called Cardinal Points, Poems on St. Louis Cardinals Baseball by Joseph Stanton. And it is from McFarland, a very well-respected press.
Excellent. Bruce, hey, thank you. Have a good time at the concert tonight. Give our best to Roger McGuinn if you see him.
I certainly will. And thanks for giving me the day off, boss. It's good to be going.
All right. We'll see you next week, Bruce. Thanks.
Yeah.